morning. Good morning. Can everyone hear me? Great. Welcome. So thank you for joining us this morning. Great to see so many folks out this morning, this first full day of fall. I have to admit, I myself am trying to hold on to summer as much as I can, but we'll be a grown-up and deal with the change in season. My name is Michelle Henry, and I manage our workforce readiness initiatives at JP Morgan Chase. I'm based in our New York office. And I'll be your moderator this morning for our panel entitled At the Intersection of Education and Employment. We know that helping job seekers, including young adults, gain the skills they need to compete in the labor market is a powerful strategy for expanding access to opportunity and promoting economic mobility. Through efforts that expand college and career readiness in low-income communities and increase access to high-quality post-secondary education, training, and work experiences, young people can really thrive. An equally important result is that businesses will benefit from building a larger, more diverse talent pipeline and contribute to economic development in low-income neighborhoods. Overall, we know there are fewer job opportunities for youth. In fact, employment for teenagers has steadily declined over the last 10-plus years, deteriorating to a much greater degree than for any other age group. And according to the Census Bureau, in just a few years, by about 2020, the majority of Americans under the age of 18 will be persons of color. As these young people are growing and developing, they are becoming our future workforce. This shift in our country's demographics requires us to rethink how we support their growth and development and change how we identify and cultivate talent. This has significant import for our economy, and in a few minutes, you'll hear from three leaders in the field who have developed innovative models that support a young person's career readiness by strengthening education program and supports. But before we begin the discussion, I'd just like to take just a few minutes to talk about what JP Morgan Chase has been doing in this space. I think many in the room may be familiar with our New Skills at Work initiative, which we announced back in 2013. It's a $250 million, five-year global workforce readiness initiative that really looks at supporting much more demand-driven workforce systems. And so on the supply side, we are investing in training providers, community colleges that are really aligned with local labor market demand. On the supply side, we're facilitating effective employer engagement and leadership in workforce programs. And through investments in data and education, data and information, like a series of skills gap reports that we released last year, we're providing the information stakeholders need to build effective demand-driven workforce systems and enable ongoing alignment between labor market supply and demand. Now, unfortunately, we know that too few young people are receiving the education or training in high school and beyond that would actually put them on a track to qualify for what are increasingly more skills-based positions. In fact, by the age of 25, only one out of every two young people, or about 52% has a meaningful post-secondary credential that enables them to compete for a good-paying job. And the U.S. unemployment rate is more than double the national rate. At a time when businesses are struggling, these young people who become disengaged represent a real missed opportunity for businesses to hire the talent they need to grow and compete. And so earlier this year, we launched a new initiative called New Skills for Youth. It's another five-year global initiative, and it's really to address the youth unemployment crisis by supporting states' efforts to improve their career and technical education systems and expand young people's access to economic opportunity. New Skills for Youth is designed to increase dramatically the number of young people who complete career pathways that begin in high school and end with post-secondary degrees or credentials aligned with good-paying, high-demand jobs. When we provide young people with opportunities to build skills, access resources, and develop their networks, they will almost always exceed our expectations. They will surprise and inspire us. At JP Morgan Chase, our global presence and scale provides us with unique insight into these issues and the ability to approach them comprehensively, opening new pathways to success. The private sector can bring a unique perspective to addressing these challenges. With our global reach, scale, and resources, We are able to engage diverse stakeholders in the conversations and focus on strengthening systems. We work with partners in the U.S. and around the world to improve access to training for vulnerable youth, to make summer youth employment programs more skills-focused, and to help young people develop the talent needed to compete for the jobs of tomorrow and succeed as adults. These programs and jobs support increased retention and high school graduation, and they are critical for gaining skills and exposure to professional cultures and sources of references. I'd now like to turn to our panelists, and I think that you have each of their bios in your conference material, so I will keep my intros very brief. The panelists will also have an opportunity to provide some opening remarks. So we will first start with Kodjo Quatri, who is the president of Monroe Community College in Michigan. We'll then move on to Simran Sidhu, who is the former executive director of Youth Build Philadelphia Charter School, and Tim Rushton, the executive director of Lehigh Career and Technical Institute here in Pennsylvania. As I mentioned, they will each provide up to 3 minutes of opening remarks, and then we will jump right into the panel discussion. So I'd like to first turn it over to Kodjo.
Well, good morning, and thank you very much, Michelle. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm from Monroe County Community College, which is in Michigan, not in New York or or anywhere in Pennsylvania. Monroe County Community College, and there's a lot of confusion sometimes. But anyway, we're approximately 52 years old at our institution. 52% of our students are on the liberal arts or transfer side. The other 48% are in the vocational or technical area at our institution. Our county has about 155,000 individuals in the county. That's the population. 97% of the individuals are Caucasian. The others are Hispanic and Black. So only 3%. But within that 3% are a lot of challenges, and our college is attempting to address those challenges. So about 3 years ago, we built a CTC, a Career Technology Center, to cater to the needs of individuals in our community in the area of workforce development and training. We have overall at the college approximately 3,000 students on the credit side, another 3,000 on the non-credit side. We do pretty much all the workforce training in the community. We have quite a few partnerships in our community. But as you can see, with 52% of our students on the liberal arts side and the other 48% on the vocational side, there is that debate on campus that's still raging. There are the liberal arts faculty who didn't want us to build the Career Technology Center, even though the community asked for it and the community demanded it. And that was before my time. I've been there for 3 years. And so we built that building. It's serving the needs of our community. But there's still that age-old debate that W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington had over 100 years ago about what was best for individuals, African Americans or Blacks. Is it career education, or is it the liberal arts? It's still raging on our campus. In terms of activities, there is X-Tech. I'll talk a little bit about that. Exposure to technology, we bring youth on campus to expose them to that. There are major initiatives in terms of the energy. The Fermi, which is a DTE, Detroit Edison plant, is in our backyard. Nuclear plant is in our backyard. There's a Nexus pipeline from Canada through Michigan to Ohio. And then there's the bridge, a new bridge to Canada that's coming. Somebody's got to provide the training for that. Lots of jobs, but who provides the training? If not Monroe County Community College, then who? And then last but not least is our Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center, which we will be launching next Wednesday on campus. And the focus is not to train young people, is simply go out and work for someone else, but how do they go out and work for themselves and create opportunities for others, the focus on entrepreneurship. And at our college, the expression I always use is, we want to provide these young folks with credentials of economic value. It doesn't have to be a degree, simply a credential of economic value. So I think that's my 3 minutes.
Great, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, appreciate your attention to the time, the
time frame. 2.52.
You get an A.
All right.
Thank you for your remarks, Kodjo. I appreciate it. Simran, I'd like you to come up.
have to go up there?
No, it's I have a PowerPoint.
Oh, okay, she has power. Okay. Should I drop the ball already?
Mostly to show you our lovely students' faces. Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to start out actually by giving everybody a gift of reading, is what I used to call it at the school when I was making staff read things. So Stanford Social Innovation Review just wrote this incredible article called Hidden Talent, How Smart Companies Are Tapping Into Unemployed Youth. And I really wish that I'd received it a few weeks ago, because it would have been my, you know, drop the article moment. I would have just said, like, here, go, and my PowerPoint would have been all synced up with it. But my thoughts are very much. So definitely read it. It's got stuff that's said in a much more articulate way than I will do, but I will make up for it by flailing my hands and conveying lots of passion. So until a few weeks ago, I was the executive director of the Youthville Philadelphia Charter School, which worked with young people in Philadelphia who are between 18 and 21 years old, have disengaged, dropped out from high school, all of them. 45 to 55% were parents, 20 to 30% had been previously incarcerated. All of this data, and actually when you read the article, as I know you will, you'll notice that in there when they're talking about sort of these 5.5 million disengaged young people in the country, that two-thirds of them have been through what they call a major life event recently. So either our parents or have you know, just come out of the criminal justice system, many of these things. And so our population at Youthville really very much reflects that, and we pride ourselves on sort of enrolling what we call the full spectrum of young people who've dropped out of high school without screening for academics or anything in their past history, and just saying, if you're ready for this, then come in. So we enroll about 220 of them every year. And then we have a program that I like to say is unapologetically comprehensive. We really fashion and design the whole program around young people and make it our business on the back end to sort of make sure the funding streams all talk to each other. There's a back office operation that makes sure every MIS system that needs every checkbox ticked off gets done. But on the front end, what students experience is a very integrated program. So 220 come in each year, and half of them start in an academic rotation, which is entirely competency-based, and the other half start with on-the-job training that ends in a certification. A lot of the work, the hands-on work that they do, is also service to the community, and so each of them is a part-time AmeriCorps member and can earn an Ed Award when they graduate. We make sure that through it all, it's wrapped up in a lot of love, very personal attention, case management, lots of sort of barrier removal, mentoring. Everybody knows, you know, things that you are going through. If you miss a day of school, about 500 people notice that you're not there. Follow up, students joke with us and say, stop stalking me, I'm at the doctor. You know, it's a very like, but that is incredibly intentional on our part. And we try to ensure that our training stays very, very hands-on and relevant and is very visibly service to the community, because we think that it isn't just at some level about a credential, although students in all of our training tracks earn at least one industry-recognized credential. It's a graduation requirement. Many of them earn a second. So, for example, in healthcare, they will earn a CNA certification as well as medical assistant, or HHA and EMT. In construction, they earn the NCCR, but also there's a new Solar Guard credential for environmental assessments and things like that. So whatever track they're in, they have to earn a credential to have something to show for it. The part that I mentioned about service, we really think that part of what needs to change essentially is students' relationship to community, and this visible work of rebuilding houses and wearing hard hats every day sort of changes how young people are viewed. And we think that when they begin to feel that value is when they believe they are worthy of self-investment and start to do really incredible things. I had a few more slides, but I'm going to stop at this one and then show the other two in response to one of the questions to keep somewhere within my 3 minutes. So we are definitely demand-driven, but a few years ago, after making a few mistakes, we realized that we were sort of seeing demand-driven as being entirely about employers because they were sort of harder to get in a way from our point of view in our world. And after having made several mistakes, we were like, wow, for us, you know, the intersection of demand-driven is really meeting student needs as well as employer needs, and we have to make sure that we are balancing that really, really well. Otherwise, we kept sort of having these mismatches. And so, you know, it's everything from fit and assessment and all of these things. And the article, again, these authors should pay me, I swear. The article again talks about this really coming to terms with this alignment of like, wow, there are 6 million entry-level jobs that are becoming available, and there are 5.5 million unemployed youth who, if we allow them to remain unemployed and do not engage them, it has very serious consequences on a human karmic level, but also in an economic level. And whichever argument you want to pursue, we really ought to marry those two things. But in there, there's a lot of very high-touch assessment for fit, and a willingness to engage really has to be a willingness to engage. And once we figure that out, we really started to form much better, deeper partnerships. We took our impact as sort of, we've stopped talking about how many high school graduates we produce and really started focusing on what is their retention and advancement in their job at least 1 year after graduation. We'd like to go longer. And so how do we, what does that 1 year after graduation look like? And how do we extend services through that pipeline very much in conversation and in partnership with an employer so that to young people it feels like they're continuing to feel nurtured and advanced in that. I'll stop now. Thank you.
Thank you, Simran. I appreciate that introduction. I'd now like to turn it over to Tim Russian to make a few opening remarks.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I want to thank you for the invitation to participate in this panel. Let me take you sort of on a two-way path here this morning. And by the way, I have a very deep voice, so I hope it's sort of like elephants communicating ultra frequency. So if my microphone is causing too much vibration over there, let me know. Secondly, it's hard for me to stay seated, so I'm not on some sort of new medication. If you see me kind of bouncing around a little bit, it's hard for me to stay still. I'm used to working in a room, so I'm going to stay planted. I'm going to ask my two associates to keep me grounded here. Thank you, Kojo. Yeah. Couple things. Let's first talk about Lehigh Career and Technical Institute to kind of give you an overview of our institution. And then let me give you some insight into a meeting I had yesterday with one of the largest manufacturers in the Lehigh Valley, largest employers, and it was a 4.5-hour meeting. And it was all about their current and future workforce needs. This way it'll illustrate what we're all dealing with and going to deal with in the future with workforce development. And I think you'll be just blown away by the numbers. And this is just one manufacturing facility in our area. Lehigh Career and Technical Institute is located about 1 hour and 15 minutes north of here, outside of Allentown, Pennsylvania. It is a secondary career and technical school, meaning that we serve students from 9 through 12th grade. So we're on the secondary side. I have 9 member districts that feed into my institution, the largest being the Allentown School District, which is a K through 12 population of about 17,000 students, to a small of like a Salisbury or Catasauqua, which has less than 2,000 K through 12. So it's a really interesting demographic swing in size of schools that we serve. It's a large facility. We are a 42-acre plus campus, over 500,000 square feet of instructional space, and we have a capacity of 2,800 students. So we are one of the largest secondary career and technical schools in the United States. It is really a significant organization. I'm very fortunate. The Lehigh Valley is very dialed into career and technical education and workforce development. That is our mission. That is our goal. LCTI, or Lehigh Current Technical Institute, is very dialed into the business and industry of the area. We work very closely with our Workforce Development Board and our school district. So there's a phenomenal synergy that exists in our consortium that is really the secret to our success. Now, let me fill you in on a little meeting I had yesterday. I say little. That's facetious, of course. It was about a four-hour meeting. The company that met with me, their name is B. Braun. Maybe you've heard of them. They're a large medical manufacturer, privately owned company. It's a German company, but they operate a substantial presence in the United States. It is one of the largest employers and manufacturers in the Lehigh Valley. They employ well over 2,000 people in the Lehigh Valley. They make IV pumps, IV tubing, IV stopcocks, and fittings and things of that nature for the medical industry. They came to see me because of this reason. LCTI's had a long relationship with B. Braun and their workforce development, but they have a significant issue and dilemma that they're facing. In the next 5 years, they're ramping up production significantly. They told me they need a minimum of 2,000 people to meet their current needs now. And just to cover the retirement of the current skilled workforce, they anticipate another 2,000 people. So just that one manufacturer, one employer alone, and the Lehigh Valley is the manufacturing belt of the state of Pennsylvania, B. Braun needs close to 4,000 people in the next 5 to 10 years. So why did they come to see us? They need our help. They need community colleges' help because they need a skilled workforce. Their largest need, besides production, is electromechanical technicians. These are the people who set up advanced manufacturing floors. They maintain them. It's pneumatics, hydraulics, motors, programmable logic controllers. It is very high tech, very high wage, high hour, $24 an hour to start kind of positions. That's one of many manufacturers that are knocking on my door and knocking on our doors because they need a skilled workforce. So it's affecting everyone in this room, and that's just a microcosm of the issue in the state and then nationwide. So just keep that in the back of your minds as we talk about the needs here and what we're faced with. Just know that every student I put out in these programs, and by the way, we have over 40 programs at our facility, every student that comes out of some of these programs, they're almost recruited like an NFL draft, and they get their multiple pick of employers. I cannot put out enough students in these training areas to meet the needs. I'm being asked by employers to expand these just to meet current needs, and that's not even considering through attrition, through retirement and such. So we have some significant issues we have to deal with.
Thank you, Tim. So clear sort of disconnect between what we're seeing, right, as practitioners in terms of working with Opportunity Youth and what employers are saying they need, right? There seems to be a ready population that should be tapped into, but for some reason the connections are not being made. So let's jump into the discussion, and I'd actually like to start with COJO. You know, I'd mentioned in my opening remarks some investments that we made in data and information, which included a series of skills gap reports, and those really highlighted what some of the high growth sectors were, particularly for middle skill jobs, those jobs that don't require a four-year college degree. I think that you mentioned some work that you're doing, particularly around advanced manufacturing and sure. information technology. And I'd like to, if you could sort of share with us this morning more about that program, X-Tex, particularly as it relates to some of the capital projects that you mentioned sure. that are coming online. I imagine that, as Tim mentioned, there are several employers in Michigan who are going to be looking to ramp up at a pretty quick pace in order to meet those goals. So can you tell us a little bit about that
sure,
program?
Sure. And so, as Tim mentioned, we nationwide in Michigan, we're not able to produce enough of a skilled workforce for the employers. There's a huge gap. And so what we've done is formed partnerships with the BDC, the Business Development Corporation, and the local K-12s. And so we're using our campus now as a hub for high school students to come and receive training. Actually, on our campus, we have a middle college. I don't know if you're familiar with, they call it early college in some states, but we call it a middle college. And there are high school students who are resident they don't sleep there, but they're, you know, they're on our campus from ninth grade through 12th grade, and they actually, many of them complete the associate degree, and it's in the STEM and health areas. Sure. They complete the associate degree before they even get their high school diploma. It happens quite a bit. And then they transfer on to four-year institutions. But in terms of X-Tech, exposure to technology, what we do is we bring young people from the alternative high school and other high schools and unemployed young folks in our community. We bring them on campus, and we expose them to various employers in the tech area. We have them complete 1 week of welding. They do 1 week of construction. They do a week of electronics, a week of auto mechanics, and then a week of mechanical design. So they come on campus, and they're introduced to all these technical areas. And these are kids who are from the alternative school, many of whom had been told that they wouldn't amount to anything. And we started that. X-Tech has been around since 1996, but we modified it last year. And so when these young people come on campus now, they're exposed to these technical fields, and we have several of them now who are enrolled at our college. They are now in college, and they're trying to get a credential of economic value. Now, working with the BDC, our local business development corporation, I want to mention three specific projects which impact not only Michigan or Monroe County, but the entire nation. One is Fermi 2. I don't know if you're familiar with Fermi, but Fermi is the nuclear plant. Detroit Edison is in our backyard, and they produce 30% of all the nuclear energy in the state of Michigan, right there in Monroe County. And so we have a partnership with DTE, or the Fermi plant. And what they've done is they gave us $1 million, which was great, to help build our CTC. But they also set aside $100,000 of that for us to use those funds in recruiting minorities and women into the CTE, into the sciences and into the technical areas. And so we've been working hard on that, and that's why we have the X-Tech program. The DTE plant, Fermi, there's a Fermi 1 exhibit. Fermi 1 is gone now. They're on Fermi 2. Fermi 2 is the current plant. They want to expand that to a Fermi 3, which may or may not happen in the next 10, 15 years. But they are seeking a renewal for Fermi 2, and I've had to testify in favor of that. You know, when you're testifying in favor of a nuclear plant being in a certain community, you're going to have protesters out there, right? But for us as an institution, it's about jobs. Is it creating jobs? Can they get that credential of economic value? So with DTE, they have a solar farm on our campus, and they pay us for that too, which is always good. So they gave us this $1 million, and apart from the $1 million, they helped us establish a NEWET program, Nuclear Engineering Technology Program, 5 years ago. And since we established that program, they have employed 25, it's a small program, 25 of our students are now employed with DTE, the Fermi plant. We are the ones who are producing those nuclear engineers for them. So that's one, the Fermi DTE. Two, the bridge to Canada. I don't know if you're familiar with the current bridge to Canada that goes through Detroit. We are 30 miles south of Detroit and 20 miles north of Toledo. So there's a new bridge coming. The Canadians are going to pay for most of it. $25 million they've dedicated to that. There's an older bridge, but that bridge opens up into the city of Windsor. So with all the transportation, and we do a lot of business with Canada as a nation. And so with this bridge now, somebody has got to build the bridge. They're only 30 miles away from us. Who's going to provide the workforce for that bridge to be built? It's got to be Monroe County Community College. And just south of that bridge is the I-75 corridor, and we are working on expanding that. We're working in our community on expanding that. So it would go from Highway 75 through Michigan to 401 in Canada. Currently, the old bridge opens up into the city, so it's not very convenient for transportation purposes. So we're the ones who are going to be training, the workers for that bridge. Our welding program is growing by leaps and bounds. And we offer, believe it or not, we offer welding classes on Sundays at 8 o'clock in the morning. and there are actually students there. I can't wake up that early for church on Sundays, but that's me. But anyway, so, and I think I have 6 minutes this time, right?
You can go ahead.
Not three. And so, it's growing. We have an AWS certification, 10-week. They take a 10-week class, after which they get a credential of economic value, and they can go to work almost immediately. We have a vent tower, which is a windmill plant in town, and they hire our workers, our students like that. So there's a high demand for welding, and then there's underground, underwater welding and subarc welding. All of that somebody needs to provide. And if not Monroe County Community College, as I say, then who? The third project is the Nexus pipeline. And that's a natural gas pipeline that will go from Canada all the way through Michigan down to Ohio. Somebody's got to provide the workers for that also. And it's got to be Monroe County Community College. So our programs focus pretty much on trying to build a skilled workforce for meeting the needs of those capital projects, which will not only impact Monroe County, the state of Michigan, but the nation as a whole.
Great, terrific. Tim, I'd like to turn back to you and the conversation you had with sort of this one employer in the manufacturing industry. I imagine that in Lehigh there are, you could have had, this conversation could be sort of replicated time and time again. Can you talk a little bit, particularly given your work with in-school youth and younger students, you mentioned starting at ninth grade, where I think it's really important because we need to start that pipeline, developing that pipeline very early. Can you talk about some of the earn and learn strategies that you have implemented and have found successful with this population?
Sure, Michelle. As Michelle alluded to, we are a 9th through 12th grade secondary institution, and we have many students who enter our doors who are 14 years old. The challenge there, though, we've actually moved down into middle school and elementary school to discuss current technical education because, let's face it, when you're 12 or 13, I don't know many students who run around and tell their parents, I'd like to be an electromechanical technician. Right? If you find them, I'm going to give you my card. All right? Please send them my way. When they get to Lehigh Current Technical Institute, and as they begin to advance their levels of training, as Michelle alluded to, the earn while you learn, we have a number of models there, as you've all heard of. One of our most successful, and it's been around a long, long time, is cooperative education. And that's where students, when they reach a certain skill level, most often it's their senior year, because you want an upper-level student who's going to go into the workplace. What they will do is they will begin a cooperative experience where they will spend, instead of spending a half a day at Lehigh Current Technical Institute, they will spend half a day in their sending school for their academic component, and the other half of the day they are completely immersed in the workplace. And they are earning an hourly wage, they work under a mentor, and they also are overseen by a certified cooperative coordinator from our institution. The mentor at the institute or at the employer has obviously goes through a clearance process, but they actually immerse themselves in that experience. And what happens very often, especially in the high demand fields, student does well, they perform well, the employer keeps them on board, they offer them a position. So when they graduate in May or June, they wind up staying with that employer. And we've had incredible success, especially in our high demand labs. There could be, here's an example. Kojo talked about welding. Last year, our welding lab was graduating 17 seniors. 17 out of 17 were in co-op, and 17 out of 17 were employed as of June. That's the kind of success rate. Electromechanical, those students have usually 2 to 3 offers for a co-op per student. Now, imagine being 17 and having people bid on you to pay you a high hourly wage and also throw money at you for post-secondary education and we want you kind of thing. I couldn't imagine that, but that's what we're faced with right now. So cooperative education is very big. Internships, because of the age of my students, apprenticeships, that's generally an 18 and older model, but there are some junior apprenticeship models we're looking at as well. I hope that answers your question, Michelle. Was that something you're looking for?
Yes, and can you just talk a little bit more? So what is there some sort of credential or sort of, you know, seal of approval that the students are earning that is making them that attractive? what is it about the curriculum? Have you developed that credential that the employers are looking for?
Not necessarily dependent on a credential. They don't have a credential per se and walk out with it. Often, many of our students earn credentials or industry certifications and graduate with them. But the curriculum is aligned with a program of study, plus it's aligned with manufacturers because our occupational advisory committees are made up of business and industry people, and they help us develop our curriculum. So they know, let me say it differently, we know what they want, so our curriculum mirrors the industry needs and standards. And the equipment we have, much like others at this table, mirrors industry standard equipment. So the students can walk out of our building and walk onto the floor and be acclimated to that equipment, and they know the processes. So it's a combination, Michelle, of the curriculum and working towards specific certifications.
Terrific. Thank you. I want to shift gears just a little bit. I started off by talking about this demand-driven workforce system, and we've heard a lot about some of the supply-side strategies to kind of make that happen. But I'd like the panelists to talk a little bit about their employer engagement strategies, challenges, lessons learned. And I'd like to actually start with Simran. She mentioned having a, quote, unapologetically comprehensive model. What she didn't talk about, but I'll ask her to share now, was some of the post-program support work that she has been doing with some of her major employers. So I'd like to kick off this part of the conversation by asking Simran to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So as I mentioned, we really figured out that sort of the rubber hit the road post-graduation for our students, and that while we sort of had them in a cocoon with us, and it's a beautiful place to walk into Youth Build, that they had to go off and be successful after us if we really were to feel like we had changed the trajectory of anybody's life. And, you know, at first there was a lot of, and we really are aware that when you sort of go any place and you are the school that works with high school dropouts, we don't exactly usually have all the doors flung open. There is a little bit of resistance, and there's a little bit, and so we sort of realized there needed to be some mindset change. And maybe that's why, you know, our conversations, sure, start with some of the demand-driven stuff from the industry, but also we know that we've got to sort of win them over a little bit. And so in designing this year after, we're very thoughtful in engaging employers there, but really engaging them. And a prime example is actually our partnership in the customer service space. Michelle, if you don't mind just clicking a few slides, there's a pipeline slide that I can. So we went from having, you know, what most schools have, which is, it's further down, I think a couple more, this one, yeah. So most schools sort of focus on that first, you know, pink phase where you're doing a lot of the competency-based stuff, they're getting credentials, they're doing the academic competencies, to then sort of, you know, towards the end of the program year and our school year in the summer, really worrying about internships and how can we send you even more. And even though our program is fairly hands-on, we wanted to get them out into employers, to begin work experiences, and so that became a graduation requirement. But we quickly figured out that if we could provide like 1 year of very concrete, tangible follow-up supports, it would help students even more. So things like a monthly transpass, whether you're in post-secondary education or your first job, every student, it's a great excuse to check in with them for a year after graduation. Every month they come to pick it up. So we started off sort of doing these things, hired a couple people to really follow up, make phone calls, to now it is a 9-person staff whose main job on one hand is this checking in kind of thing, but the other part is being very, very embedded with an employer so that the feedback cycle starts and so that we are doing a really great transfer over to the employer at the end of that first year. So, for example, in our customer service training track, We have funding from Starbucks that funds sort of the first part of it. So they are, we have a Starbucks cafe in the school. Students do their first few barista training hours there. And I will say, you know, when we first piloted a barista training track, the board had this very interesting discussion, right? They went like, what are we doing here? You know, like the construction credentials sounds better. You know, suddenly it's like, are we producing the baristas of the world? But it was really interesting because as part of that discussion, the board members went around and it turned out every single one of them had a son, a daughter, a nephew, a niece, a cousin, somebody who'd worked as a barista, because there happened to be about 80,000 of them. The difference is that the expectation for those young people was not that they would always stay baristas. But when our students get barista jobs, part of the panic is, oh my gosh, that's what they're gonna be. And we sort of realized that if we did this well, that isn't what they needed to be. That what needed to happen was with the employer to talk about advancement. And so now we have really great employer partners, including Starbucks, but also Saxby's, Subway, Wawa, who are sharing curriculum with us, who are, you know, sharing their evaluation sheets with us and really coming in to understand for a change, sort of asking the questions that say, what are we doing wrong? Rather than, let me tell you why your graduates are not really prepared to succeed in our environment. There is this complete shift in conversation, and it's because we've built that relationship and sort of taken this, removed some of these false credential ideas and sort of talked about competencies and what can you build at work and how do you balance both high accountability but also empathy in the workplace. And, you know, design around, like, if 50% of your workforce is 21 years old and younger, like 18 to 21, then you really need to have positive youth development principles very strongly embedded in all your HR training. So come to us, let us be the youth experts, and we're doing this. So Saxby's head of curriculum and training for their baristas is working with our director of curriculum to make sure that the training is much more in sync with who they're actually attempting to train. And meanwhile, we keep designing incentives that are in keeping with an employer. So, you know, Saxby's has various levels that you go through. Fantastic. Can your managers talk to our mentors so that we are then saying, hey, here's your incentive for getting promoted. And then we've designed together playlists, because that sounds better to students than a list, a playlist of things that students need to do that gets sent to them that says, hey, here is your playlist for the first month. Take a colleague out to coffee. Do, like, engage with somebody. All these things that nobody ever talks to our young people about, and yet they're constantly evaluated on those things, but no one's telling them, here's how you ask, don't stand still. How many times did you go up to your boss this month and say, what else can I do to be helpful? How can you go up and say, what is the next level training? Can you show me what you consider when you're promoting somebody? To have those conversations, bring it back to us, and then we design training with them. So it's a very complete but employer-embedded second year of follow-up.
And Simon, just to follow up on that, I am gonna ask you two questions, which I don't like to do. One is, the feedback that you've gotten from employers, has that sort of further informed your own program design, right? So I find it difficult to believe that it was just we're going to teach you, employer, about business development principles, and we're gonna keep doing things the way that we do them, right? There's this constant sort of shifting and learning, shifting of perceptions, shifting of policies and practices. So can you talk a little bit about how that's informed your own program design?
Absolutely. In fact, I think this thing that you're talking about, our ability to adapt programming and listen, was the number one thing that got employers invested. So the thing that they noticed about us was, wow, we gave you this feedback last month, and now we see that it's already happening in your program. And so, you know, and that's those funny arrows up there, right? Like, one part of what you learn completely impacts your own training. So we are sort of the feedback center that also gives Starbucks feedback on its curriculum that we implement based on what their own store managers are actually saying to us, right? So that it's this constant process of, yes, this is how they're doing, this was missing, here's where we can do more of some component of it to make sure that they're ready. But I think it was also partnership on many levels. Even we began to evaluate partnership quality as well as potential for impact. So, you know, there was a time we partnered with we were so desperate for anyone to talk to us that if you were a company and came in and spoke with us, we were like, okay, what can we do? And then we realized, well, there's only some employers that are actually coming to the table with these types of intentions and that can hire large numbers. So let's invest our partnership time in those employers so that they fully feel how responsive we are and really, really engaging with them, both on some emotional level. Yes, we talk a lot about return on investment, and it's amazing the numbers there, right? Mm-hmm. I think in this paper that I recommended alludes to it too, but there is like, it costs someone, you know, if you have a worker who's making $21,000 a year, and every time they turn over, it's $3,500. If you have high, which I think Starbucks in some areas had a 72% turnover rate in the first year, if you multiply that, there is a lot of incentive for investment. And so that's a wonderful conversation, but there's also this sort of human conversation of, listen, these are young people in our community, and you've come in and you've met them. So we've hosted, you know, all of Starbucks employees in this area, all the managers coming in to work with students, because there needs to be that emotional connection when you're talking about hiring young people that you know are going to make mistakes in that first year. And we also started talking to them about, hey, we're taking a sectoral approach, but would you do that too? So that when a young person leaves, it's not complete colossal failure for each of you. And, you know, Starbucks and Saxby's, for example, are talking to each other to say, all right, here's a child who did not do well with us, bombed out, in fact, but they learned really important lessons because Youthbill's mentor was involved. So Starbucks, when you get them, they're going to be a better employee, but guess what? They deserve that second chance. And so as a sector, we're building in a little bit of failure, like the I don't want to call it failure, but this opportunity to learn the first time you bomb out even, because young people need that. And in that sector, you still gain because you're hiring back someone who bombed at Saxby's, and you get someone who's a little bit more ready to advance. So this idea of not just giving up because the first two young people didn't do well with you, but coming back and telling us what went wrong. And there's incredible changes happening. I mean, I'm optimistic in general, but, you know, just to see a company like Starbucks, for example, and it's funny because I used to be one of those people who told my daughter to go to independent cafes and all this, and now I'm like, no, go to Starbucks, it's fine. But you know, you see a company like Starbucks that actually came to us and said, so three of our young people got screened out because of their records, and they came back to us and said, well, if we're serious about working with Opportunity Youth, this is going to happen a bunch. How do we become more nuanced? And their HR system changed, and those young people work with them. There were young people who bombed four interviews, but were doing really well with us. And we said, we don't know what's happening. And they said, great, let's have a learning session together. Then we'll hire him. You know, so this idea of not giving up and both sides being really resilient around young people.
Great, that's terrific, and we'll look forward to sort of keeping up with how YouthBuild is building this strategy with other employers. I believe this is a fairly new tool that you've begun using, so we'll be looking forward to that. Tim, I wanna turn to you. You mentioned your engagement with lots of different actors in the workforce system, including the WIB. Can you just tell us a little bit about some of the strategies that you've used in terms of engaging employers that has led to this, you know, sort of really high demand for your graduates? And I'm sorry, just before you begin, I'd just like to, after this, I'll have one more question. So if folks can start thinking about any questions that they have for our panelists, we'll open it up to the audience in a few minutes.
I guess the best way to illustrate this, you know, the three core tenets of any real estate transaction is location, location, location. In career and technical education, and that's the case for all of us sitting up here, it's programs, programs, programs. So the quality of your programs is directly proportional to the success of your institution and the success of your students, hands down. So quality then is number one. So how do you get that quality? How do you maintain it? How do you continually improve it, and that comes only with the curriculum you deliver and the advisory council that you build for each program. We are required, I'm not going to bore you with Pennsylvania educational regulations, because that'll clearly put you to sleep rapidly. But out of Chapter 4, these are academic standards mandates out of the state. We fall under what's called Chapter 339. It's a career and technical education standards and mandates that we must follow. Part of that requires us to have what's called occupational advisory councils for each program. So every one of our programs, we have over 40, has a council that meets twice a year. So it is incumbent upon the instructor, not the school, but the instructor, to build this advisory council. Diversity of counsel is important, so you have to have the breadth of the manufacturers in the area. For example, I'll go with electromechanical. So you want your B. Braun's of the world, you want your Nestle Waters, you want your food manufacturers that use very high-end advanced manufacturing. You want members of those companies to be on your advisory council. What happens then is that these people meet and our instructors review safety, review equipment, they review the curriculum with these advisors and ask them if it's meeting their industry standards. They make recommendations as to equipment, and we do not make a move in our school allocating resources to any equipment or curriculum unless we have OAC stamp of approval on it. The meeting lasts two and a half hours. They take minutes. Just so you're aware of this, the teacher doesn't run the meeting. The OAC council runs the meeting. There's a chair and a vice chair. They run the meeting. The teachers sit sort of on a periphery and provide information as needed. So it's almost like a school board meeting. So that happens twice a year. This is absolutely required for us to make any move. So that allows us, Michelle, as you're alluding to, that allows us to make sure that our school and our programs meet their standards, because if we do not, and they want our students as a direct pipeline, if the curriculum isn't matched, if the equipment isn't matched, then the student will not be matched to meet the high demands of that workforce. And remember that here's the challenge, though, in current technical education, is it's an expensive endeavor. In electromechanical, in precision machine, they could recommend you need to have on your floor a $200,000 Sinker EDM machine, right, that uses electronic discharge to take away metal for manufacturing process. You need to have that. So we have to find a way then to fund it, because if we don't have it, that's yet one more step behind the eight ball that they are when they leave our institution. So that is the core of our philosophy, of our delivery, and that is vital to what we do. And like I said, I'll end on this. We don't make a move without our OAC's approval.
Great. Thank you. For the final question, I'd like to pivot just one more time. We've heard a lot about training. We've heard about some employer engagement strategies. Kojo, in your remarks, you mentioned the opening of your new Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center just next week, I think you said. So can you just talk a little bit about that strategy and how you are engaging opportunity youth in thinking about not just training for a job, but how they themselves can become employers?
Sure. I'm an economist by training, and I was dean of different business schools before becoming president, and we've started quite a few entrepreneurship centers. But I think the challenge for us in Monroe County is, currently as things stand, if anyone in the county wants to start their own business, they have to either leave Monroe County, go to Toledo, go to Detroit, or go to Ann Arbor. Not everyone, a special opportunity, you don't have access, they don't have the wherewithal to get to those places. So how do we create a place? How do we create a place in our community for them? And so next week, what we're launching, we're working with several groups, quite a few volunteers. There'll be mentorship available. And when one thinks about the concept of entrepreneurship, people just simply think about business, somebody starting their own business, yes. But it's about innovation and entrepreneurship. So the young people will have access to our CTC, our Career Technology Center. They'll have access to our 3D printers. If they want to start a business using a 3D printer, they'll have access to that and training for that. They'll have access to our welding equipment, to our CAD equipment. They'll have access to our mentors from the SBA, Small Business Administration, coming from Ann Arbor, access to individuals in our community with the local banks who can provide loans to these young people. And we're working with a group called Generation E Institute. And what they do is they provide training for young people before college or K-12 to become entrepreneurs. So we're purchasing a curriculum from them so we can begin to go into the schools. We bring all the eighth graders in our community on our campus once a year. And that's to give them exposure to what we have available on our campus. And so it shouldn't be about us simply training young people to go to work for someone else, but for them to go out there and create opportunities for themselves and for others who may come after them. So this is a great opportunity. We will have also makerspace mm-hmm. on campus. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but you don't have an office. There's a place where you can go. We're a community college, and I always say our responsibility is to serve the community. That's what differentiates us from other kinds of colleges. We serve our community, and our taxpayers certainly hold us accountable to that. And we're going for a millage in November, and so I keep saying that. I keep trying to sell that concept. But and I know we're pretty much out of time, but it's really to create opportunities for anyone in the community who wants to start their own business. You can come on our campus and get help.
Terrific. And is this modeled after the Innovation Center at Macomb Community College?
It's a combination. A melange, if you will, a hodgepodge of several that we've looked at. Macomb Community College, we've looked at Adrian, Spring Arbor, several institutions. Okay. So very similar to that.
All right, terrific. So next Wednesday is the launch.
It's the launch.
Okay.
And you'll be there, right?
Good luck. In spirit. I will be with you in spirit.
In spirit. There you go. We appreciate it.
Terrific. So I'd like to open it up now in the remaining time that we have for any questions from the audience. There's actually a mic that we'd ask you to use because the session is being recorded. And if you could say your name and the organization that you're with. Please feel free to make your way to the mic so we can have successive questions.
Good morning. My name is Renee Murdoch. I'm the corporate responsibility officer at First Niagara Bank, and I'm from the local market here. My question is, each of you seem to serve potentially a different population. Community college, I think mostly about adults, even though you do have some young people.
Sure.
And I was surprised to find out that your Career Institute covered 9th through 12th grade, and then your school at Youth Build has youth that have some significant event in their life that has taken them on a different path. How do you recruit students to your different programs? I'm thinking about how do you get enough students to feed the different industries that will need employees? How do students end up at the, not end up, but attend the Career Institute as opposed to going to a traditional high school? And your students who are, I'll use the word troubled for lack of another word, which that's not necessarily the best one, but they're not necessarily the ones who are going to raise their hand and say, I'm ready to go to school now, I'm ready to go back to school, or I'm in a good enough place for this. How does that happen?
Just very briefly from me, in terms of the youth we have on our campus, the middle college, we have a waiting list for our middle college. But that's different from the, you know, the number of adults has been declining. And we've gone from having 478 students just last semester, youth on our campus, to 615 this semester. So that's growing with dual enrollment. And the other thing we found in terms of the challenges is that the employers now are competing with us. They're going directly into the high schools to provide apprenticeships and internships. So the students, those students aren't coming to us. They're going directly to work for the tool and die companies. And so that's a challenge for us as a community college. But that's the extent of my comments.
Renee, that's a great question. Recruiting, and I'll try and keep it concise for you, but recruiting is a constant battle we fight at the secondary level. And let me say that for a couple reasons. We also, by the way, at Lehigh, have an adult education component, so we do educate the adult, very robust, very industry-specific, customized job training for our industries. But getting back to our 9 through 12, You recall when I spoke earlier, I alluded to the fact that most 14-year-olds don't run around and say, I want to be an electromechanical technician. I really wish they did, but they don't. So it goes back, when you really reverse engineer this, it goes back to, first of all, mom and dad. And when you drill it down, it's actually the number one, when you look at the research, and there's some interesting research on it, mom has the most impact, especially middle school-wise, directing their child one way or another. So it's parent. We also have guidance counselors in the sending districts because most of our students come to us for half a day. They spend half a day on current technical ed. The other half, they stay in their sending district for academics. Although we do have a small academic center, about 400 students, where they stay with us all day long. But a lot of it's driven through guidance counselor recommendations and such. The battle we fight, we all fight it, but the battle on the secondary level we fight is that everyone needs to go to college to be successful mindset. And that is a battle that began to wage about 30 years ago, and we continue to still fight it. So that mindset is something we continually work on every day. And interestingly enough, in our adult ed training, more and more students with degrees who can't get jobs in their degrees and have loads of student loan debt are coming in for training and technical education to try and get jobs. So recruiting never ends for us. We've actually asked our employers, like Kojo alluded to now, employers want to now come into our schools. And we have them in now for career days and things like that, but they want to come in now, and even, like I said, it's like an NFL draft. They want to get more engaged in the school because they're losing. The competition is so fierce for these students in these high technical trade areas and advanced manufacturing that they know if they don't get in there, even into middle schools, that they're going to lose out. So it's an interesting dynamic, and we work on that constantly. Great question.
For us, actually, we get about 8 times as many applications as students we enroll every year. We're a good option for that young person who's like, I'm sick of sitting at home, or I just had a baby. What example am I going to set for them? We don't screen on anything other than their desire to be with us. We refuse to sort of be a mandate. We're very much like, you have to want to be here. And so we have this process of engagement where they come in, they have to come in and sort of attend an orientation session with us where we have like 10 staff sit with them. There's a lot of small group work because that's how the school works. And we want them to have the best sense of who we are through every process because it's a tough year. I mean, it's very intensive, but there's a lot of preparation for that. And many of them, when they come to us, have never had to think through questions like, what are you good at? Silence. Nothing, you know, and so in that process, we do a lot of priming for that kind of stuff, like come in, learn to talk about yourself, what are your interests, what would you like to do, and then we do something called mental toughness training. It's 6 days, and it's 6 half days, and every day they have to come in on time in that thing to get in, and on the 3rd or 4th day, they attend the graduation of the class before them, so that they get to see very visibly what it will be like. And each year we wind up with somewhere between 220 and 235 young people who finish all of those things and decide that they want to stay with us. So it's sort of a selection model. About 60% hear about us through word of mouth. So someone tells them they should come here, and it's usually sort of parent, grandparent, sibling, friends. Lots of friends recommending that they come, and then 40% is we advertise on SEPTA and Facebook, the transportation line, so that there's an ad that sort of says, do you want to turn your life around and get a high school diploma? So.
Great, thank you. We have another question.
Hi, yes, my name is Adam Steinberg. I'm the Mellon ACLS Public Fellow at Reinvestment Fund, a CDFI here in Philadelphia. A few years ago, I read in the Chronicle of Higher Education that 44% of students in higher education in America attend community college, 44%. But only 2% of philanthropic dollars go to community colleges. That seems like a big mismatch. And yeah. My question is, that's actually for all of you. What strategies have you pursued to increase philanthropic funding of your institutions, especially from high net worth individuals and corporations? And also, what can the entire education sector do to increase that kind of philanthropy to these institutions?
And I guess I'll start very, very briefly. I know we're almost out of time.
here, right?
Yes, please, yeah. go ahead. We have a little bit of time. Yes,
and so we have a foundation, and we are going to the private donors and seeking funds from them. And you see, community colleges, because we are supported by state dollars and also by many states, we have the taxpayers, local taxpayers support us. So we have this concept or this, I guess we don't focus on private funds as much. And so what I've done since I've been over the last 3 years is try to change that. We're going after more grants. We're going after not only the DTEs, but Lazy Boy in Monroe, that's the headquarters. And so they've been generous to us also, got $1 million from them also. And so we're going after more of that as institutions. What was the second part? What can higher education?
Yeah, I guess more is like not just what you do for your own institution, but what can we all do for all these institutions?
Yeah. Well, I know you've got some money. I know you got some money, so give us some more money. All right. Our foundations have got to be more proactive. Yeah, most definitely.
But I think it's also sort of important to start talking about what it takes to support a young person through community college. So full year of support is 90% privately funded. And, I didn't sort of say too much about where I'm going. I'm transitioning out of Youth Bill, but where I am going is actually someone who funded a large part of that work. And a lot of what we're trying to do is, like, where are these youth spaces that have not been funded? And I think what's really interesting, if I can say this, I think about 5 to 10 years ago, the word innovation was not being closely enough associated with community college. But there has been a sea change, including some amazing leaders, including like in Philadelphia, Dr. Generals is kind of incredible on what he's willing to do. And the conversation we had with community college 10 years ago compared to the one we're having now is completely different. And also this idea of like, we serve community. We, are the places where you could do really great pilot programs and figure out how to change things. And I think as that happens more and more, I'm hoping that more energy gets created around doing private and sort of both individual as well as corporate funding of those things.
I'll be brief as well, because I know we have time constraints. Funding, we're a public school. So 85% of my budget comes from my 9 school districts. Now, in Pennsylvania, current technical education subsidies have been flat or level funded for almost 10 years, so we have not seen an increase in that. But where does private dollars? That's an interesting question, Adam. Private dollars is actually a new phase of an initiative that I've actually started going down that path more and more, because I have to try and reach out to try and find more dollars because it is so expensive. We just brought on Cabot Oil and Gas at Lehigh Current Tech Institute, and they've given us a $10,000 scholarship because the gas industry is going to eventually migrate further and further south, affecting the Lehigh Valley, so they're being proactive. So I've actually put my grant writer on that task this year to find and secure more foundation monies, because the amount of students in need, all right, Current Tech Ed is expensive, welding masks are expensive, uniforms, steel-toe shoes, they're all very expensive, and they need those to be successful in a program and for safety. So some of the foundations I'd like to establish are to just help kids get equipped just for success. So it's with public schools, that's sort of a new path, but we have to look at those avenues. So that's a great question as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. We have one final question.
My name's Greg Wilson, I'm with NCRC, and we do some workforce development. One of my question has to do with community colleges and graduation rates and retention and the role that remedial education plays in that retention rate.
Yes.
In the state of Delaware, the 6-year percentage of kids that graduate after 6 years from the Delaware Technical Community Colleges is 20%. In some of the campuses, it's 11%.
Right.
What ends up happening is that reinforces a negative information loop in low and moderate income communities, where community colleges and technical community colleges are seen as ways out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And they happen to rotate back into high crime areas. So I'm interested to hear what the national numbers are like for a graduation rate from the technical community colleges over 6 years to get a 2-year degree, and what your strategies are for improving remedial education to provide that expedited graduation rate, right?
Right.
because a lot of kids get discouraged when they have to take remedial classes. Yeah. They don't count towards their degree.
Yes. Thanks. Yeah, and I guess this is my question, and I'll be very brief. Yes. So nationally, it's 20%. That's the graduation rate for community colleges within that 150% of time, which is 3 years. But we've come up with a new measure, which better suits community colleges, and that's the VFA. A VFA measure, as opposed to the IPEDS measure, which the federal government currently uses. That shows us in a better light. But to be fair to community colleges, a lot of young people who come to us so they can then take a few courses and then transfer somewhere else. So the real measure of success for community colleges should be the transfer rate plus the completion rate. When you look at that, it's over 50% in many instances. And so that's what we really, that's how you measure success at community colleges. In terms of remedial education, a lot of young people who come to us perhaps couldn't go anywhere else. They come to us, the four-year institutions don't do remedial very well, so we have to do it. We have to give these young people a chance. What we're doing, for example, at Monroe County Community College is forming a partnership with the K-12s. So we're doing test prep. Every Friday we do test prep, campus prep on campus. You see, what's unfair about, oh boy, here I go, soapbox.
I'll back up.
Okay. About remedial education, is we give these kids one test, the compass, and then we label them remedial, and we know 90% of kids who go into remedial never complete. I called it a roach motel on campus. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know. In front of the faculty, they got upset with me. Because our kids go, but what we're doing is taking these young people's money, knowing they're not going to be successful, and that is unconscionable. It is, and so, but again, that's I'll go back on campus and fight that battle. And so, long story short, is working with the K-12s, doing the test prep. Every Friday we have it on campus, so young people are coming on campus free, so they can better be prepared for the tests, the compass test. We're giving them two or three opportunities to take the compass, and then we need to go beyond just that one measure and have multiple measures. You look at their GPA, look at how well they do on the SAT or ACT. Look at multiple measures. So you don't put those kids into the roach motel, you give them another track. So they have a better chance of being successful. So that's what we're working on. But, you know, higher education is stuff. There's so many committees. You got to go from, and as a former business dean, I hate that. You got to go from this committee to the next committee. Anyway, I'm done.
I think this kind of leadership is what is changing so much of it, because we have this same conversation for years.
Yeah.
And we were like, what are you talking about? Like, they're dying in there, our students.
It's a roach motel.
Right. But when you have new
leadership, never heard of it that way.
Roaches go in and they never get out.
But now, you know, there's dual enrollment happening.
Right.
So our students who want to go to community college start while they're still with us, and we get some of the remedial ed out of the way so that our math course is their math course. And so that there's no disagreement. And a lot of that is sort of faculty talking to each other, figuring it out. But I think also this idea that, like, learning has a deadline is really weird. And so I think more and more contextualized stuff so that, yes, you need to work on, and I agree with you. I mean, you guys get, you know, everybody who has not hit levels at math and English and all those things. But if there's a way to do it along with more contextualized stuff. Otherwise, even at, you know, Thaddeus Stevens College, which has a much higher completion rate, we were sending students there, and they were spending, you know, their solution used to be, if your student doesn't do well in math, let them spend 8 hours a day in math. And anyone who knows young people thinks, really, that's what you're going to do? And you don't have privilege to the gym. You can't do this. It's like, no. Let them go to the gym and then teach them math. You might actually, you know, and so some of this is happening differently. Sorry, now I'll get off.
Yeah, and just one final point. I was, prior to coming to Monroe County, I was the provost at the City Colleges of Chicago, serving 120,000 students. We spent $33 million a year on remedial education. We changed that and went to multiple measures. And we actually did interviews, and so that the graduation rate went from 7% to 14%. Whoopee! It doubled. It doubled, but we went from 7% to 14% by having those multiple measures. Sometimes what it is the grit factor for young people. Are they motivated? And that's what that was one of the factors we began to look at, and not just a score, your score on a test, one test, and you're labeled remedial for life. But
Michelle, let me just 30 seconds.
Sure.
Just to show you the support and the link between secondary and post-secondary current technical education with our community college partners, many of our programs at Lehigh, students will graduate with 30 credits through articulation agreements, where they'll literally go right across, in our case, the Lehigh Corbin Community College is literally across the street from us. Kids walk, although it could almost be in Canada because some of them just don't even, they don't make that connection, but they can walk across the street and have 30 credits in their pocket toward an associate's degree, just some articulation agreements with our curriculum versus theirs. So that partnership is vital.
Great, thanks, Tim. So we've covered a lot this morning. We've talked about partnerships, the partnerships between the K-12 system and post-secondary, partnerships that engage our employers and industry leaders. We've talked about innovation. And this last topic, which I don't know, Keith, perhaps this we're like teeing up for another session at another time around measures of success. What are the metrics that you're using, and how are we really, what's the data that we should be collecting to demonstrate that to the philanthropic community, to our employer partners? So we might think about how we continue to explore those conversations. I'd like to ask everyone to please give our panelists a round of applause. Thank you. I'd also like to direct your attention in your packets. There is an evaluation form. If you could please just take a few minutes to fill out, and we've got a few minutes. Just wondering, would our panelists like to leave the audience with any closing remarks, any other calls to action, or anything else that they can take away before moving on with the rest of the conference?
15 seconds. I hope you'll leave here with a greater understanding of the need, the absolute urgent need for the skilled workforce in the United States. So become an advocate, right? Talk about it, be realistic about it, and your friends that have that one track up to success, illuminate them as to what you've heard and what you're hearing from the experts in the field, because we're already behind the eight ball, and if we don't address it, we're going to have some significant issues going forward.
There are quite a few projects that are going on in Michigan and Monroe County that are impacting the entire nation. And so, as Adam here said, we need more private funds. So all of you, I'll give you my address. You can send me a check.
Is that call to action? I know it was
that
coming.
Call to action. Send me a check, please. But thank you for your participation.
I'll end with sort of words of a 15-year-old. My daughter was looking at photographs of young boys the other day, and I heard her say to her friend, "Oh, he could totally be someone who glows up." And I said, "I'm sorry, what?" And she said, "Glow up." And I was like, "What do you mean?" She's like, as he gets older, he's either going to get really cute or do something really remarkable that'll make him glow up. And I thought, that's really kind of cool. And so I've become like, let's make sure every young person doesn't just grow up, but glows up. So wherever they are, positive youth development, really sort of keeping them at the center of our conversations all the time.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's give Michelle a round of applause.